Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston and I'm going to be with you for the next hour as we delve into some of the major stories here in Ireland and from around the world. Coming up on today's show, we're going to explore the great American transport question. We'll be looking at everything from the Baltimore Bridge collapse to the chaos that's happening at Boeing, which we obviously have also covered here last week. But these are seemingly isolated incidents. Are they indicative of a broader dysfunction in the system? Joining me later to discuss is Rana Fuyuhar, who is the global business columnist and associate editor of the Financial Times. Then we'll be shifting our focus to building here in Ireland as we look at REITs, or Real Estate Investment Trusts, to give them their full title. And we're going to be seeing if they could provide the solution to the future funding for building more houses here in Ireland. And finally, how much are you willing to pay for United Ireland? Well, according to a recent report published by the Institute for International and European Affairs, unification could come at a cost of an extra 20 billion euro a year to the Irish government for 20 years. I'm going to be joined by one of the co-authors and asking him some questions about those findings. If you want to get in contact with us, please email us on takingstock@newstalk.com or also open on Twitter at StockNT. Well, it caused more than a bit of a stir when the Institute of European Affairs published their report into the potential cost of the reunification of Ireland. And I'm delighted to be joined now by one of the co-authors of that report. Edgar Morganrath is a full professor of economics in the business school at Dublin City University. Edgar, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, how are you?
Now, Edgar, it's actually called the Northern Ireland Subvention Possible Unification Effects, and we'll come back to all of that in a second. But I just want to get your thoughts on the timing of the report. Did you give much consideration before putting it out there? And what's your view on the reaction to the findings of your report?
So the timing of the report is really simply a function of when we finished it. There wasn't any special timing. We didn't sort of work to a particular deadline or a particular date when we wanted to have this out. We simply did the work, finished it, and published it. So there's nothing special about the timing.
No, I'm asking so that because obviously it does inspire a lot of political debate, as you've seen. Were you surprised by how much traction the discussion got?
Slightly, because this is actually an update of an earlier paper that John and I did on this back in 2019. And indeed, we appeared in front of the Oireachtas Committee on the Good Friday Agreement twice. So it isn't terribly new. And indeed, there are other papers that have looked at this. And not just more recently, but going back in time, the Northern Ireland Subvention has attracted a bit of interest, but it never seems to have gotten the kind of media interest that I guess we got over the last week or so.
I guess what that demonstrates then is the difference in the political climate between 2024 and 2019. So now this is a real debate that you're entering into, and for sure we have to have these economic assessments. But what I was fascinated by was I had also seen the paper in 2019, and it was a paper about subvention effects. So I just wanted to kind of get your view on that. And it did spark a lot of kind of commentary from people like the former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, who said this question shouldn't be about money and making about money is wrong, and similar from other people. But of course, we have to look at the practicalities of this as well. And I suppose that's why I wanted to ask you the question about the response to it. So before you tell us about your findings, maybe what I wanted to look a little bit at is the caveats within the report, where you started from economically, what assumptions you were building into this, because I do think that that does contextualise some of the findings. And also, I need you to explain to me and to our listeners exactly what the subvention is and what it means.
Let me start first of all with the kind of comments that people made about Irish unity not being about money. It is, of course, true that some people will have an infinite, place an infinite value on Irish unity, but it it's rather reminiscent of the Brexit debate, where the Brexiteers didn't want any analysis of what was possibly going to happen. And ultimately, I think that was found to be the wrong approach. And in the case of Irish unity, it's not just a joining together of two parts of Ireland, but it's also a leaving of one part of the UK from the UK. So it's actually a little bit more to it than to Brexit. And you know, if we're not going to look at the detail, we're going to end up finding that we're going to have to look at it in very rapidly whenever unity happens, and probably end up making mistakes and costly mistakes. So I don't accept this kind of putting down research on something that is actually very fundamental and very important to plan for. And if the Taoiseach thinks we shouldn't be doing research on this, I think he's wrong. Or the former Taoiseach, I think he's wrong.
Mm. But what would you say, sorry, to cut across you there, what would you say to somebody who says that just putting forward your analysis of the effect of the subvention was a bit unbalanced and one-sided?
In what way is the question?
In that it didn't really consider the potential investment opportunities. I know they're hard to quantify, but you know they are looking at it from a political perspective and saying this is a very negative assessment of the potential reunification at a time that's politically sensitive, without giving any counterbalance.
Well, firstly, we're not looking actually at the unification costs as a whole.
Which is why I mentioned this is about subvention.
Those are actually significantly larger. Mm. And there are a variety of things that haven't been considered at all, but that need to be planned for. And then on the potential benefits of unification, other than that people will feel better about, you know, they have emotional attachment to a unification, which is perfectly understandable and legitimate. There is a kind of a promise of benefits by some people who haven't actually done any analysis on regional development.
Well, some research has looked into the positive aspects of the potential for inward investment, say.
There's been work done in the context of a changed corporation tax rate in Northern Ireland, but what hasn't been considered at all is to what extent that might suck potential investment out of the rest of Ireland. So I think those sort of things have not been looked at properly, and. Again, there have been other studies. There's one that's often cited by Kurt Hübner and others from British Columbia in 2014, which left out whole swathes of effects. It basically assumed them away, which I think is not credible. And it didn't lay that out in the open. It was more hidden. I think what we're doing here in our study is simply to say, without any changes, what would be the implication of a unification to fiscally, simply to pay the wages of the civil servants, et cetera, and where instead of a subvention, which is essentially a transfer of resources from Westminster to Northern Ireland, that subvention would have to be paid by the Republic of Ireland.
Mm.
Of course, it's very simplistic because we have ultimately, you know, a lot of potential differences when there are negotiations and so on. But a good starting point is to start with the worst case scenario. And as I said, we're only looking at part of the potential costs. There are a lot of other ones that may actually be bigger than what we're looking at.
Mm.
And in terms of the sort of static nature of what we're doing, again, people have said, oh, well, but over time, things will change. Over time, things may well change, but they may change for the worse as well for the better. And it's not certain at all that they will change for the better. And if you go back to the Brexit analysis, and I did rather a lot of it, and I started a long time ago doing this, that analysis was also always typically static. And some of the people who are now saying, well, this is a static analysis, that's not good, they weren't saying that the Brexit analysis was no good. In fact, they supported it.
And I guess that's a standard procedure, is it, to start from a standing base and not build any positivity or negativity into? How could you predict?
Exactly. But when we come to the potential benefits of Northern Ireland, we're always told that somehow or another Northern Ireland's going to transform economically, just by taking away the border. The facts of the matter are that within Republic of Ireland, the weaker regions have not thrived either, relatively speaking. So that's the evidence we have, that within a Republic of Ireland that has been doing remarkably economically, we haven't seen convergence either. Dublin is way ahead, and it's pulling further away. So the evidence that we have is actually suggestive that maybe the weaker regions are going to do worse rather than better.
Yeah, and that's something I want to talk a little bit about, is the regions, because a lot of people don't understand that we have regional subvention already here in the Republic. It's just not called out, I suppose, in the way we would call out what's happening in Northern Ireland.
Yes, and again, I published research on this quite a while ago. We don't have an explicit system like the UK, which has the so-called Barnett formula, which distributes resources, and likewise Germany has a Finanzausgleich, which distributes resources across regions. But we do have is a fiscal system and a welfare system. And if you have areas or regions which are more prosperous, you tend to collect more tax there. And if you have areas where there might be higher unemployment or other kind of social issues, you tend to spend more there. And when you actually work that through, you find that in the Republic of Ireland, Dublin is by far the biggest kind of tax source. And Cork comes after this. So that Dublin and the Southwest, in the study that I did, came out as the only regions that actually made a surplus, and all the other regions were de facto getting a subsidy. And so that's not unusual. That is something that you see in every country. And so that doesn't really raise eyebrows. You know, every country has different regional differences. We don't see any countries that don't have them. And whether they have an explicit system or one that is sort of implicit like ours, there will be transfers. The really big issue is the size of transfers. And, again, Northern Ireland within the UK is relatively small, and therefore the subvention, the level of transfers, the difference between taxes and expenditure has not been a big political issue. The problem for the Republic of Ireland is that Northern Ireland is relatively large relative to any other region. So if you think the west of Ireland, for example, Northern Ireland's four times the size. And it receives roughly, and those calculations are difficult to make for the west of Ireland, roughly twice the subvention on a per capita basis or per person.
Just explain that bit again about the per capita piece and how it differs from what you found for Northern Ireland.
We can take the difference between taxes and expenditure as a whole for a region and divide it by the number of people, and we get a per person subvention. And when you do those calculations, you find that the one that the north of Ireland receives is roughly twice that of what the west of Ireland receives. And then you have to take into account that the north of Ireland is, of course, four times the size. So it's a substantial amount. And that adds then to the potential. So if Northern Ireland was a smaller region, it would probably not matter so much. It would not affect the overall fiscal balance that Ireland has. Because it's so large and because the subvention is relatively large, it starts affecting us if what we assume came true. So you'd either have to raise taxes or you'd have to reduce expenditure, or you somehow or another reduce the subvention. Now, those are the sort of things, questions that I think are very important from a policy perspective. What can we do so that this scenario does not arise? Okay. And simply wishing it away is not going to make it go away.
Yeah.
Right. You have to plan. And this is where this kind of study and more work is, I think, going to be vital. If you go back to Brexit, Ireland was extremely well prepared. And that was because Ireland started doing research much before the UK did.
I think if the study shows us anything and the discussion around it, it is that we need to have these debates and we need to have these discussions, and Irish unity, whenever it might happen, is not something that can be rushed, and that will require a transition period. I think, I don't know if you saw, Cliff Taylor was writing about this after the publication. He kind of boiled it down to two issues. The first was calculating what bills might transfer from the British Exchequer to R1 post-unification. The second was that very complicated question of what's the economic impact of reunification. But neither of those really can be calculated before the negotiations take place. You don't know what's going to happen at the end, but we do need to be informed. So going back to 2019 and that report that you did on the subvention there, and looking at it now, was there anything that came up that really surprised you or shocked you that was an outlier?
So what you can see is that during the COVID years, the subvention in Northern Ireland increased substantially. And we only have data up to 2021 right now, and it did drop again in 21, but certainly 2020, it went up quite a bit. So we, you know, overall though, the trend, and this is something that's worrying, regardless of unification or not, for Northern Ireland, the trend is upwards. So the subvention keeps on creeping up. It bounces around a bit, but overall, it's just getting larger. And it's getting larger as a percentage of GDP. And it has been over 20% for some time, for about 10, 20 years. So if you think about back to the financial crisis, and we were worrying about 10% deficits in the likes of Greece, it is actually bigger in Northern Ireland. Now, again, regions tend to have bigger deficits, but it becomes it's a function of what's underlying in the economy of Northern Ireland, and that's the worrying thing. So this is basically something like the pulse of the Northern Ireland economy, and it's not very strong.
That creeping dependency then, is that political stability or instability affecting it, the bartering that went on around Brexit and stuff, does that feed into it? Or what causes that mission creep, I suppose, if you want to call it that, for dependency?
So the Northern Ireland economy has a relatively low productivity, and there are a bunch of factors that feed into this. One of them is education levels. They're considerably lower than those in the Republic of Ireland. And again, this is something that simply taking the border away isn't going to remove. This is going to take some time to fix. You've got basically a hangover also of troubles effects, if you can call them that. You know, during the troubles, there was very little investment in Northern Ireland, particularly of an FDI nature. The sort of long-term effects of those kind of issues, we call them sort of path dependency in economics. So where you know you're going the wrong way, and it's very, very hard to turn that ship around. That's kind of where Northern Ireland is caught in a economically not going in the right direction. And policy, I guess, hasn't managed to overcome this. Not having governments in place that could do something about some of the underlying issues certainly doesn't help. whenever there's that kind of political uncertainty, it doesn't help in getting foreign direct investment into Northern Ireland.
Well, Edgar, sadly, I wanted to talk to you about Germany and comparisons, but it is a very accessible report. I would say that it's just 11 pages. It's very well worth reading, and certainly addition to the debate on this very complex and unprecedented change potentially in our relationship. But for now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Edgar Morgenrath, who is Professor of Economics in the Business School at Dublin City University. Edgar, thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you.
You're listening to News Talk's Taking Stock. Rana Farooqar is the global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. She's based in New York, and she's been looking at the creaking American infrastructure. She'll be coming right up after this short break. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, the ongoing crisis at Boeing, the Baltimore bridge disaster, and the crumbling highways across the US, are these isolated incidents or examples of a wider malaise in the American transport system? Well, this was a question that was asked in a very thought-provoking article by my next guest, which she wrote last week. It's a great pleasure to welcome Rana Farooqar, global business columnist and associate editor of the Financial Times, to the show. Rana, thank you very much for being with us here on News Talk.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you might start us off today by highlighting some of the key problems of the transport sector in the US. We talked last week on this show extensively about Boeing and what's happening there. And obviously, the world watched on in horror at what was happening with the Baltimore Bridge as it collapsed. But could you talk us through some of the other issues that our listeners here in Ireland might not be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. What's happened at Boeing, what's happened in Baltimore, the fact that the American electric vehicle industry is slumping at the moment, the fact that we have a new trade case coming against China for dumping in shipbuilding. America can't build its own commercial sea vessels anymore because of China ring-fencing the industry. All of these things speak to a larger systems problem. We have an economy, really, that over the last 40 years has been designed to raise share prices and lower consumer prices, and nothing else matters. It doesn't matter if your planes are safe. You know, it matters if Boeing's share price is going up, but it doesn't matter if we have real safety and resiliency in the sky. We see the same thing in the Baltimore Bridge disaster, where crumbling infrastructure all around the country has been an issue for years. We know this, and yet we don't have the incentive for repairs. This is something that the public sector has not funded really since the Eisenhower administration. The Biden administration is trying to do a real record investment now, but of course they've come under a tremendous criticism for that. And it's, you know, it rolls out over time. So we have problems with bridges, with roads, with trains. I mean, don't even get me started on overland train travel in America, which is just a disaster. And we also have a lack of joined up thinking, frankly, about how transport systems should work. You look at something like electric vehicles, and while on the one hand, it's great that this White House has put money into the green transformation, we don't have a systemic approach to this the way that China does, for example. So you look at the fact that EVs are, they're great, they're clean, but they're going to displace 40% of the automotive labor force. What are we going to do with those folks? What are the political ramifications going to be? How are we going to get the critical minerals necessary for the green transition? A lot of those are ring-fenced by China. So you can see what I'm saying here, that a lot of these things are connected in ways that people don't necessarily realize.
Absolutely. And I think that's what was so intriguing about your article, because we tend to look at these as isolated incidents or sectoral problems. But absolutely, when you go through them as a collective, you do get a very big sense that there is no joined up thinking when it comes to those huge infrastructural issues and questions. And in a way that maybe other countries are, like China, etc. But one of the areas I'd like to explore with you a little bit is the shipping area in particular, because there was lots of stuff I learned, in particular the Jones Act and how constrained the building of vessels, even shipping vessels, are within the United States. Could you maybe explain what that Jones Act is and how curtailed it is between transportation is between ports in America?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just an incredible antiquated piece of legislation. It actually came out in 1920. It was a piece of legislation that said that if you want to ship domestically in the U.S., meaning go from U.S. domestic port to port. So to transport something, say, from California to Texas or from Texas to Boston, you need to have a ship that is built, crewed, captained, and flagged in America only.
And what was the rationale for that at that time in 1920?
Well, it was a security rationale. But, you know, to be fair, there was also a certain amount of protectionism involved. It was about protecting U.S. labor markets. There are ways, I believe, to protect U.S. labor markets that don't result in us being unable to transport our own liquid natural gas from port to port, which just seems sort of ridiculous. This is, again, going to the fact that we don't really have a joined up system. We need to think about legislation that's out of date. We need to think about labor markets. We need to think about how trade works. We need to think about shareholder value and whether we need to be thinking about safety and not just share prices. All this has to be taken on board at the same time.
And of course, if you think of it, shipping by water is cheaper and cleaner than truck or air. So if we're talking about a new greener economy and to lean into Joe Biden's objectives, this is one area that they could certainly tackle very easily. But it has practical and economic effects as well. Maybe just look for a second at that container ship accident that resulted in the collapse of the Baltimore Bridge. Can you just talk us through what the economic consequences of that actual accident were? And I suppose maybe the wider discussion that you're trying to have about even if the government are utilizing those type of ports to their fullest potential.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Baltimore is a major port. It sits on one of the biggest natural waterways in the world, the Chesapeake Bay. This was an important port, and it's had immediately a couple of billion dollars worth of economic impact just in terms of what can and can't be shipped, what's coming in and out, the shifts that need to be made to supply chains, the energy and labor costs involved in those. But, you know, in some ways, the impact could have been much bigger if Baltimore was actually being used to its fullest, because one of the problems with the limitations on how shipping can be done in the U.S. is that you get, even though it's cheaper to ship things, you know, in a maritime vessel, it's cleaner. You get a lot of things being pushed to trucks, getting pushed into even to airplanes, which are, you know, incredibly polluting and expensive, because the rules simply don't allow shipping, say, from Baltimore through river systems to the Great Lakes, where you would have a tremendous manufacturing hub that could be serviced in that way. So there's just a lot that needs to be rethought.
And I guess the consequences of that accident are still being felt in supply chains and other tertiary industries around it. Any indication of how long that might take to restore a large piece of infrastructure like that?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. For many years, folks have been saying this bridge will not be able to stand a direct hit from a ship like the one we just saw. People have known that since the 1980s, but there was not the impetus or the economics to rebuild. They're obviously going to have to do that now. How, when, how fast, you know, who knows? We have a really hard time building things in this country. You know, we are very good at leveraging things. We're not so good at building things. And politics is in a very difficult place, as you know.
One of the things you say, Rana, in the article is, and I quote, what the U.S. has in some cases is the worst of both worlds, hyper-concentration in key industries, which you've already gone through, but in the name of security. Can you talk us through that national security issue and why you think it's so pervasive throughout the consequences for the transportation sector?
Yeah, and I'll actually expand it even beyond the transportation sector. So Boeing was allowed in the 1990s to buy up its biggest competitor, McDonnell Douglas, for national security reasons. The idea was that we needed a national champion. You know, Europe has Airbus. We need Boeing. It's going to make sure that Americans always have air travel and we're safe in the skies. Well, actually, what happened was you got very little competition and you got a highly concentrated industry that has not been disrupted in any way. So it's fat. It's very financialized. There's investment going into stock buybacks, but not necessarily into R&D. In fact, R&D as a share of revenue has been falling relative to Airbus for many, many years at Boeing. But this, it's interesting because this failed argument about national champions is actually now being used in the technology sector as well in the U.S. So Lina Khan, who's the head of the FTC, recently gave a speech about this saying, you know, if you think national champions work, look at Boeing. And now take that argument and look at something like Google or Amazon. We don't need national champions. We need competition in the market. The U.S. markets are very, very highly concentrated. I mean, four stocks represent 30% of the S&P right now.
Yeah, yes, it's incredible. And just to stick with Boeing for a second, because you've described it very well there, and we had a big discussion about this last week and the management structures. That idea of a fat, lazy company and the competition, you're so reduced, non-existent. What are the consequences on other things, though, like research and development, innovation, and even safety, in your view?
So when companies are highly concentrated, it means that they simply don't have to run fast. They can use their extra cash to do stock buybacks, dividend payments. That's great for the top 10% of the population that owns 85% of the stock, but it doesn't invest in the seed corn of the future. It doesn't invest in safety. It's also incentivizes companies to really just focus on the bottom line as opposed to innovation. So you see this in a lot of big companies when they go public, and particularly when they're in highly concentrated industries and they're ring-fenced and protected, they end up having, as I said, the worst of both worlds, where they're supposedly national champions, although I certainly wouldn't say that Boeing has lived up to that. But they're also incentivized to pay back shareholders rather than investing in the sort of things that would push the industry forward.
One of the other industries that you mentioned, and particularly comparing to what's happening in China, is the electric vehicles industry, of course, which has been big in the news recently because of the Tesla share price falling, the lack of sales within the industry, and I suppose the general disappointment that it hasn't gone as well as many would have hoped in terms of consumers. But the bigger picture of that, the US now trying to subsidize EVs, that's fine. But you mentioned that they're not going beyond that to try and secure minerals and materials and even batteries with that strategic approach in the way that China are.
Well, they're starting to realize that there are more issues here. Before the war in, before the situation in Gaza, the national security defense departments were really looking carefully at the fact that China owns 80-90% even of some of the critical minerals in the green area. You know, the things you need for lithium batteries, the things you need for wind turbines. These are ring-fenced. And so they were starting to think about, well, gosh, how can we, you know, arrange purchasing agreements with countries? How can we look at friendshoring with European nations to maybe buy things jointly and do, do deals with the countries that have these minerals? But now the focus has really sort of gone off those things. You know, people's eyes are elsewhere. They're looking at the Middle East, to these old conflicts and ongoing conflicts. And so I sense that there's a little bit of lethargy around this. And meanwhile, and by the way, you can see that in Tesla's share price, which has been going down. Meanwhile, China is just leaping ahead and really blanketing the world with cheap, clean technology and electric vehicles. And it looks like they may win the race.
Absolutely. First up, best dressed and all that. Rana, finally, I wanted to ask you, you know, we have this phrase, culture eats strategy for breakfast. So if you lift us out of the transport and even the energy and national security issues here, what do you put this back to? Is it a lack of political vision? Do you think it's symptomatic of what's happening in politics in America? What's your view on why this has gone awry and there is no strategic vision and an overall strategy, someone driving a big mission for the U.S.?
I think at the broadest level that really since the Reagan-Thatcher revolution, you've had a movement towards more corporate power, more private sector power, less government power. It's almost as though we've forgotten in this country that government can do things. We should remember that because government managed COVID pretty well in the U.S. I mean, you know, for the most part, we got vaccines out there. You know, there was an industrial strategy. Things worked. It can be done. but there's not really that muscle memory at this point, although I think it's starting to come back. I think that when we look out in 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to look at the Biden administration as a tipping point to a new kind of political economy. And all of these crises, from the pandemic to the war in Ukraine, the supply chain problems there, to what's happened at Boeing, to the collapse of this bridge, as impetus to remember that we need a more balanced system. We need to think about the public sector and the private sector and individuals sharing risk and responsibilities together. And we need to get to a system that is good for workers, good for communities, not just good for the top 1% of the shareholding population.
If that trickle down effect, if it's planned and process properly. But it's a fascinating look at that system and the question of national security. Rana Farooqar, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Now, the government said it needs 11 billion euro per annum to meet its target of 33,000 houses per year. And he'll need that from the private sector. Could REITs be the answer to their prayers? Find out after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, have you ever heard of a real estate investment trust, or REIT, as we now know it for short? Well, these property investment tools were introduced to Ireland in the aftermath of both our property and our economic crash. Now, of late, they've fallen out of fashion, but now the government is to undertake a review of them. And I'm delighted to be joined by Kathleen Gallagher from the Business Post to look at their past, present and possible future. Kathleen, welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been looking at this a lot recently. Maybe just start us off today by explaining what exactly is a REIT.
Yeah. So a REIT, a real estate investment trust, is basically a portfolio of buildings owned by a company, and that company is listed on a stock exchange. And the rationale for that being is you can have investors who want access to the property market. They want to invest in the growing property, for instance, here in Dublin, but they don't want to buy an actual building. So here, there's a company that manages that, and then you or I could buy shares in that company or sell the shares.
So look, it's a really good way to invest in the property market if you think that market is on the rise, but you don't actually have to get involved in the building side of the property. So these investors then, do they pay corporation tax? Who regulates them? How does it differ from other investment portfolios?
Yeah, so they're quite specific structures, and therefore there's a lot of different ways that they're run. So there's specific requirements to be a REIT, so you have to redistribute a certain amount of the income to be considered a real estate investment trust. So for instance, if I was a REIT and I owned a bunch of apartment blocks and they were out to rent, a proportion of that rental income has to go back to shareholders within a specific time frame. Mm-hmm. So there's very strict regulations on that. Because of the way they run, they also have different ways they deal with tax. And those are managed by governments. So Ireland has a specific REIT regime, and it sets out what the REITs can and can't do and what they must do to qualify for that.
Mm. Maybe, Kathleen, take us back to when they were introduced in the market here in Ireland, and who came in and how did they perform?
Yeah, absolutely. So they were started in 2013, kind of as you said at the beginning, to facilitate investment into the property market here in Ireland. And then four came to the market, but not between then and 2018. So you had Green, Hibernia, and Ugrove, and IRES REIT. Mm. So of those, IRES remains. It's the only one that remains. They kind of hit the peak in 2019, where they had 3.8 billion in property assets and had raised 1.8 billion in equity. From kind of 2019 onward, you started to see them steadily leave. So Green exited the market in November that year, and then Ugrove and Hibernia exited in 2022, which kind of leaves us with just IRES at the moment.
Yeah, and we might look a little bit later at why they left. But when they were here, they did attract a lot of ire from people who felt that they were exploiting our economic misfortune. Was that a significant part of their departure or their lack of interest in the Irish housing market? Because it is a very buoyant market in that there's a great need for property supply here.
Yeah, I mean, that is going to play a factor. If there's continual bad blood about a company, it's not something they want to deal with. But there will be other reasons why they decided to depart. There was a review, I believe it was in 2019, by the government, and it put in some extra restrictions on REITs that made it different from how REITs operate in other different markets. And KPMG have come out and they've said that that is one of the main reasons that you saw those players leave and return the assets back to the market, because it just made them made the structure not viable anymore.
Mm. And you mentioned there the first four who invested in Ireland in a REIT structure. The one that is left is Iris. They're going through their own structures and changes at the moment. And in that change, we've seen a new type of REIT emerging, perhaps with a green hue, which might prove popular for investors who are seeking things in the future. You might talk to us about what's going on at Iris at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So Iris is undertaking a strategic review. It's had a very difficult kind of time from a corporate perspective over the last, well, few months, years. It had an activist investor who basically was challenging Iris, saying that it wasn't managing the assets appropriately and the value was coming out of the product. And so they've launched a strategic review, under which they're looking at a number of things. Do they start to sell off some assets? Do they wind down completely? Is the REIT structure appropriate anymore? But also, like, do they just put a different bent on it in terms of what they're targeting? So that particular entity is very much up in the air in terms of its future.
Okay. So if we just expand our viewpoint beyond Ireland and look at the REIT structure internationally, who does it well? Is the US, is it prominent in the US investor landscape when it comes to property?
Yeah, absolutely. So the US is seen as the most successful in this space. It has over 150 REITs. Obviously, the US is a much bigger market, but it has done it very well. Those are seen as very established, well-run REITs. You also see quite a lot in the UK. It's got a large investment trust structure in general, and then REITs make up a significant proportion of that. So they have just under 50. Mm. And then in Europe, it's been less of a big takeoff. I think, especially at the moment, you're seeing REITs really struggle, and the future of European REITs in general is starting to come under question about whether or not they can survive.
Mm. And what's the attraction for investors in a REIT specifically? Is it easier to access your money, like, beyond normal property investments?
Yeah, absolutely. So a REIT is seen as the almost the perfect structure for property, according to some investors. Basically, the way it's structured is that if you or I want to invest, we buy shares and sell shares. So it's incredibly liquid. It's just buying any other company on the stock exchange. And that influences the share price. Mm. It doesn't operate as another kind of property fund, where if I pull out my money, the fund then has to find some way to deliver that money to me. And that normally involves the selling of assets. And so that leads to what they call a liquidity mismatch. Mm. And it can force the owner of the fund to become a forced seller and obviously not get the true value of the asset. So a REIT is seen as a very attractive way to take a bet on a property market in a structure that is good for investors and the managers.
Yeah. And then if you look at the experience of the companies who came in here, those original four, okay, you've said it was relatively hard to do business because of the increasing regulations. And sorry, not putting words in your mouth, I think you were referring to a KPMG report there. And I've mentioned that reputationally, some of the companies would have suffered a great deal because of protests against them and political opposition to them. What about government support for REITs? Were they into this as a mechanism to help the property market, in your view, in the past?
I think, you know, they did acknowledge that it had its place to play. I mean, that's why it was instituted as a thing in 2013. They saw that having outside investors come in and support the property market in a time when it was struggling was incredibly valuable. I think, you know, governments, they are influenced by public opinion. The public, as you pointed out, they were not particularly happy with these companies. And so I think you probably did see government support for that idea waning.
Mm.
So we've talked about the fact that they're reviewing these. In the review, they did state that they felt like a REIT was still important from a from a perspective of achieving their housing targets. Mm. And it was one of the things they asked respondents to kind of come back on, and whether or not they thought that was something that should be considered for the future.
Yeah, but the government has said that even if they were to stick to, let's just say it's a conservative plan, but Dara O'Brien's target of 33,000 houses per annum, they would need 13 billion, and 11 billion of that would come from the private sector. This review, beyond that, how could the government even attempt to attract REITs back into Ireland, in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things going on there. I think, you know, a look at the regulation needs to be done. There are differing views on those kinds of consultation responses. KPMG said that, you know, Ireland is out of step in some respects. Other responses, they said that Ireland kind of was in the same area as other regimes. But it probably deserves a close look at whether or not that being out of step is an impact. I think you also kind of need maybe a bit more information to the public about what a REIT is and why it would play a positive role, if that is something that the government is trying to pursue, because perception is very important there. And, you know, it can do more than just housing. It could help the stock market here. There are very positive things REITs can do, but they would have to put, you know, enough emphasis behind that to attract the investors to come into the market in that way.
Absolutely. And what's your view, Kathleen, of the credit situation for property developers if we take the REITs out of the equation and just look at what's left for them, the banks, the government lending fund? Is there enough money being given to property developers at the moment if without the likes of REITs in our market mix when it comes to finance?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you definitely need these institutional investors. You need these big players. Now, whether they do that through a REIT or through other funding, private funds are very popular because you don't have all of these kind of stock market dramas and all of this transparency about what's going on. But you do need the institutional investors to come in and put some money at work here to get a lot of those projects over the line. So they have to be encouraged in. Sometimes it's not very palatable to think about them kind of owning the properties of the state, but ultimately they have the money to get the jobs done. So there's a balancing act that needs to be achieved there.
Finally today, Kathleen, on looking at this issue, and you've obviously talked to a lot of people about it, like Dublin and Ireland in general face an acute shortage of housing. Did you get a sense that there's a willingness to invest in this type of product should it be regenerated by the government?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, property investors, they are looking at Dublin. They find it a very attractive market because they see such demand, and the kind of supply and demand dynamics here are very attractive from an investing perspective. I think the REIT structure, whether or not that is the particular one going forward, it's up in the air. But I think they are, in general, very interested in gaining access to the market.
Oh, well, look, as you say, perception, very important. Maybe a bit of education around this wouldn't hurt. But Kathleen Gallagher from The Business Post, thank you so much for taking the time to take us through all of that today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And now, while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. For now, thanks to all of my guests today, though, and thanks to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, with Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt on research, and Hugo Da Silva Scott was on sound. If you've got any comments on today's items, please email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.